Objection! Hi, everybody. Welcome to a special year-end edition of Objection, the worldwide leader in contrarian a-holery. This is David Johnson, joined, as always, by Dan Mancini.
Greetings.
And it is a new... We are recording this on January 1st, 2013. So it is a new year.
Yes, indeed.
It is a new year. We may or may not be going over the fiscal cliff, Dan. I have no idea. But
you know. Yeah, I think we've gone, but
we've gone.
I haven't felt
we've
anything.
Gone. Absolutely. So yeah. So if anyone hears this recording following the looming economic apocalypse, please share this with the other wandering nomadic tribes out there.
Yes.
But we're not here to talk.
We're in the bunker. So
we're in the bunker. Yeah.
Zombies out there, and
I mean, as paid employees of the old white man cabal, we have our own Scotch-filled bunkers. Correct.
Exactly.
So they've seen the looming disasters ahead, and they've furnished us with just some fantastic recording equipment as well, I have to say. So thank you, old white man cabal, for coming through as always. But again, part of that is we're contractually obligated to do a year end or year beginning episode, whatever you want to say, kind of a look back, look forward. So this is us fulfilling that contractual obligation.
Indeed.
So we do have some stuff we want to look forward to, and by stuff I mean not much because we are contrarian a-holes. But let's look back at a couple of movies that rate pretty high in our corners. But we feel that I don't know how would you explain that the pop reaction to these movies, Dan?
Yeah, I would say that 2012 has been the year of nerd and critic backlash douchebaggery. Mm-hmm. It's been a year defined by, hey, this is a great movie, but I'm just not content to go on the internet and say this is a great movie, so I'm going to be dissatisfied and nitpick and just be a douche about the whole thing.
Even though maybe a couple of years ago you were embracing the filmmaker, you know.
Exactly. Especially if a couple of years ago you were embracing the filmmaker.
Yeah. So this is kind of our look back at what was nitpicky douchebaggery in 2012, as it's specifically relates to two movies. Now, before we get to those two movies, we were banding about a third movie. So let's just kind of talk about that real quick, Dan. That was
yes.
John Carter.
John Carter, yeah.
I think the most costly flop in Hollywood history, something like
yes.
that.
Yes, right? And the one that definitely qualifies as everybody wanted to be a douchebag before they'd even seen it.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, and I think you, and all those – so you had Disney, which you obviously always want to kick to the side. You had – Andrew Stanton, right, who was a Pixar guy, I guess he was fresh off his success with Pixar, right? So this
yeah.
was his first live-action foray, so he was probably ripe for dart throwing since he's been on the pedestal for so long.
Yes, and Finding Nemo, right, was his
– Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Which is, I think, their most successful.
And is actually on a re-release now, a 3D re-release. So, So in all those lined up, and then it starred the kid from Friday Night Lights, right?
Right.
With a terrible last name. And it looked, I guess, it looked like Avatar, even though Burroughs kind of preceded Cameron a little bit here. So
yeah, it looked a little like Episode 2.
Episode
2,
yes, absolutely. So it was kind of going out of the gate undermanned, and it was pretty much gleefully pooped upon, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
And so I did. I ended up seeing it. I will say it's no great shakes. It's probably just seems more like pedestrian to me than bad. But I guess there's a lot of worse things that deserve ire more than that, I thought.
Yes, it did not deserve ire, I don't think. It's definitely pulpy. I thought the beginning stuff with all the voiceover narration setting up the world and explaining everything. I thought the movie could do better without all that stuff.
Yeah.
Just show us and maybe design things a little bit so that we can tell the difference between good guys and bad guys just looking at them. so nobody has to – Willem Dafoe doesn't have to explain it to us. But other than that, I thought it was a good-looking movie. I mean, Burroughs' source material was heavily ripped off by James Cameron for Avatar. And I thought it was a much better movie than Avatar.
Oh, see, there you go.
Much.
That's the contrarian a-hole we were looking for. There's the rub, and I agree with you. And I think our thoughts on Avatar are pretty clear. But, yeah, I mean, at the very least, it wasn't just ridiculous. It didn't go out of its way to preach to you about anything, you know?
Right.
At least I don't recall that. So, and I mean, the hero even though both heroes in both in Avatar and John Carter kind of bound through the air using CGI, I mean, at least the hero here was somewhat likable, you know?
Yeah, yeah, and it might be my jaded, I hate Avatar eyes, but my recollection of this movie, Stanton did a pretty good job of delivering kind of the exuberance of the character discovering he could leap far and everything. And Cameron, by contrast, has a character who is in a wheelchair and still can't make you feel excited that he has this giant blue cat body and can run around and jump and climb and all this stuff. I just didn't feel any kind of vicarious experience in the Cameron movie.
Right, and he's and our buddy there is more interested not in the new locomotion he's discovered, but the ability to have biblical relations with the prince's betrothed, you know, in lieu of stopping bulldozers from killing the cat people's village. So I think he was more interested in the reproductive elements of the cat body than the joy of running and jumping. So
he definitely had psychosexual issues.
I think so. So I'm not going to go here and raise the flag of John Carter and say it's just the greatest movie of the year. I think it was just, you know, pretty pedestrian, but it wasn't awful, and it had moments. It had some moments of like discovery and fun, you know.
I definitely had fun.
Yeah. And so we'll set that aside. That's definitely not the hill we're going to die on. But the two movies we're going to look at, two of arguably the biggest movies that came out this year, at least with some of the most hype, was The Dark Knight Rises, which we've talked about before, but we've got some added insights to it, and The Hobbit, which will be kind of new for us to get at. But before we get into The Hobbit, building on The Dark Knight Rises, we've talked, and I think we both arrived at a similar conclusion, myself after watching it a second time for reviewing for DVD Verdict, and subsequently a third time as well, that there is, and I might be there already, if not, I just need a little shove, maybe. I think The Dark Knight Rises may be better than The Dark Knight.
Yes. And I think I'm there.
Okay.
I've watched it. I mean, I saw it in the theater twice because I took my son after seeing it with my wife. And then I've seen it probably two times on Blu-ray, something like that, two or three. And the more I watched it, because I wasn't there the first time I saw it.
Yeah, I'm with you. Same here. Loved it, but had some misgivings. What, you know, following up watching it backfills a lot of questions I had. Like, a lot more things are tied. You see a lot more, more of the smoke and mirrors I thought Nolan was using are actually kind of addressed in subsequent viewings.
Right.
Especially as it relates to, how come I blanking on the, Not who she's revealed to be, but, you know, Bruce's girlfriend there.
Bruce. Oh, yeah, Miranda.
Miranda Tate, yeah. So
yes.
A lot of the questions I had about her, her and her ability to see the fusion reactor or whatever were kind of addressed earlier on. So, yeah, I definitely appreciated that. But I think just kind of a lot of the themes that Nolan was going for really resonated even more, even when I knew it was coming, I think. So.
Yeah,
you know, you're listening to what Bane's talking about. You're seeing a lot of this stuff happen. You understand why Bane doesn't just wax Batman, you know, when he breaks his back. I mean, there's there's a point to him throwing him down there in the pit. So,
and there's there's a comic book element to that.
Sure,
but that's what kind of movie it is. I don't, if this was a purely realistic movie, I don't know that motivation would work. But I think it works in a Batman movie.
Yes, right.
Even in a fairly realistic or more, I guess, sort of pseudo-realistic Batman movie. But I think, the mechanics of it, I think one of the things people aren't used to, especially in a comic book movie, is we're used to this sort of being given an omnipotent view of events. And Christopher Nolan doesn't give you that. A lot of times you only know what the characters know. And we've talked about this before, how you're given information before you really know what to do with it, what it means. It's only later, as the plot unfolds, that you realize, oh, that's what they were talking about. And sometimes you don't pick that up in a first viewing. And I know we've talked about stuff, but just her plan and, you know, there are a lot of subtleties that I didn't pick up on until three viewings in that could, you know, you could say, oh, this is a plot hole, but I don't really think it is. But stuff that I haven't even seen anybody seen someone who is inclined to backlash against the movie even bring up. Like, what is, I realized maybe third viewing or fourth viewing that, she's in that when she pushes that trigger, her intent is to die.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Right.
It's not to escape.
No, right. Right.
And so, and that was like what's her, even when she goes out and hops in the tumbler, there's no survival.
Right.
But I think, you know, it's one of those things where he's not going to explain everything. Nolan's not going to explain everything, but I think the pieces are there. You can infer what is happening. And, you know, I think in that instance, once Batman comes back and they realize he's there, I think both she and Bane have to commit to dying in Gotham.
Yeah.
In order for the plan to go off.
Right.
If they're serious about destroying the city, they've got to die because if they
know he's ascended to kind of this new level.
Right.
And I will tell you this, that the thing that occurred to me watching that, the biggest theme, and I missed this the first time around, but I picked it up, and it's Bane, when Bane tosses him in the prison and he's talking to Bruce Wayne and he's talking about how using hope as this poison, you know, using hope as this poison. To me, that was like, that is something bigger than any comic book movie I think has talked about, and any Nolan movie. I mean, it was fear and chaos, the first two movies, I would say. Fear and chaos were kind of the things that could drive Gotham to implode, you know?
Because there's this reversal that's really interesting, because Bane is using hope to poison Gotham, but hope is the reason that Bruce Wayne created Batman.
Absolutely.
Produce hope in Gotham.
Absolutely, which is why I was able to kind of look past, you know, one of my little, you know, nitpicks was, you know, how Batman really took a lot of time getting back to Gotham to cover, you know, to make the bat signal and gasoline, right? You know, at the very end.
Right.
So, but it's critical. Like, it's critical that happens, that he lights that up. And that it shows, you know, it burns and it shows, I mean, it's like the point. It's a point of Batman. So,
right.
So I'm sure Nolan probably said, where does he find the time to do this? But it was one of those things where the bat signal smashed and it's the inverse, like you said, it's the inverse of Bane's weapon. But I just found it just super absorbing that, you know, the third, cause really it's not so much the villains that wreak havoc on Gotham. It's kind of the weapons they wield. So, like, you know, in Batman Begins, you know, Scarecrow and Ra's al Ghul, yeah, they're memorable villains, but they're using fear as a weapon. Right? You know, fear is the weapon that they are using. Because, again, and I think we talked about this, but the Gotham City is the prize being fought for over all three films. You know, the soul of Gotham. Gotham City itself, looking at Gotham as a character, kind of illuminates this stuff, I think. But Gotham City is the prize that is, you know, fought over and over and over for. So, and then the second one, the Joker, just Joker is chaos, and through the chaos and the watching the world burn stuff, he feels like, you know, people will just kind of be reduced to animals and consume each other. And then along comes Bane with a third weapon, which is even more terrifying, actually, just that slow poisoning with hope. As again, a lot of metaphors here, but Bruce, look, you know, that's why that prison. It's so diabolical because you can see the sky up there, but you cannot get to it. But it keeps you going, though. It kind of, you know, maybe looking at the sky and thinking maybe you can do it keeps you from hanging yourself. So.
And it's a tie back directly to the first movie.
Yes.
Because in some ways you could call The Dark Knight Rises Bruce Wayne Begins, because it's really the story of Batman becoming Bruce Wayne again, because he has to relearn the fear that he learned to put aside in the first movie.
Yes.
In order to survive. And I mean, one of the reasons we talked about it being better than The Dark Knight is it's just ballsier than The Dark Knight. Where Nolan went with this movie.
Yes.
Is way beyond where any comic book movie has gone.
Absolutely.
And, you know, to me, it just sort of hit it head on at the end where people have the most problem, you know, that ending and the nuclear bomb and, the countdown, people have said, poor writing because the 5-second countdown and how did he get out and all this stuff. And that's not a writing issue. That's an editorial issue. And I think He did that on purpose. And the reason I say that, you know, it's not apologizing for Nolan, or because I am a Nolan fanboy, I will admit.
Yes.
But I think it's there in the prestige and how it lays out, this is how a magic trick works, and we're going to show you something that the truth is sort of there, but you don't want to see it. You want to be fooled. That idea, I think, is in the final moments of Dark Knight Rises, that something about when we go to a movie, we do want to be fooled. We don't want everything explained. And then when you look at, I mean, Nolan has said Tale of Two Cities is a major inspiration of the movie, and you can see that once he says it. And, you know, that's a book where at the end there are two characters, two male characters, and one of them dies on behalf of the other. Goes to his death because the French peasants think that he is the other guy. And he could reveal that he's not and save himself, but he opts to die instead. And it's his last lines in the book that Commissioner Gordon reads at Bruce Wayne's funeral. What Nolan is driving at, I think, and forcing us to sort of, you know, deal with, he's confronting us with it with that 5-second countdown, is he's treating Batman and Bruce Wayne the way the comic books always have, like they're two people, two different people. And the beauty of it is Batman in the comic books, there's never a resolution for the guy. You know, it's always pain. It's always suffering. It's always dealing with his parents. And Nolan takes the opportunity in Dark Knight Rises to allow Batman to die, not just for Gotham, but for Bruce Wayne. And that's what the 5-second countdown is, I think. It forces us to view the two characters separately. And yes, Batman dies at the end, but Bruce Wayne lives. Yes, and it doesn't make sense on a literal level, but based on the character's history and everything, that shot of Bruce Wayne happy, that never happens in the comic book. It never happens in any other movie. And that's why it's subversive. The idea that, you know, Nolan copped out with a happy ending. No, he didn't.
Right.
A dark ending is the simple ending of a Batman story. You know, he managed to find a happy ending for a character who never gets happy endings, ever.
And you've heard, and like Bale and Nolan have talked repeatedly about how, you know, they really wanted to, you know, Bruce Wayne is what they're most interested in, I think, as a character. And that's borne out in how much is dedicated to Batman Begins. And, you know, I think, I remember some criticism about, oh, it's all exposition, it's all character building for Batman Begins, but you needed that hour or so of Bruce Wayne development to really kind of pay off the whole series, I think. I mean, is the Dark Knight Rises ending as powerful if it were not for that, you know, that devoted buildup of Bruce Wayne and Batman Begins? I don't think so.
No.
You know?
Because you have to feel that Batman is a curse somehow.
Yes, that's
that
right.
He's, and this explains also the fact, the sort of 8 years of nothing.
Yes.
You know, is he's
not quitting.
He's beaten organized crime.
Right.
He's beaten organized crime. He feels guilt over Rachel Dawes' death, but that's not the primary reason. There's really nothing left for Batman to do, but he is Batman. He's not Bruce Wayne anymore. So what is he supposed to do? All he can do is sort of walk around his mansion and be depressed.
Well,
because he's not a human being anymore. Well, he is only this curse that he carries around.
And as they say in The Dark Knight, again, it's oft quoted to the point of cliche, but it is that Batman at the end of The Dark Knight is the Batman for Gotham. Right there, the patsy, pretty much, you know, for the death of Harvey Dent. So, and that's who it is. So I just think it really rewards subsequent viewings. I think it's ballsy with a lot of its treatment of stuff that's both cutting edge as far as, you know, as far as social commentary, but rooted in like old school things dating back to, you know, the Reign of Terror and the French Revolution.
Yeah, the Occupy movement stuff is, you know, give me a break.
Yeah, it's
and,
not,
and that's another thing. Like, if you're at all familiar with Tale of Two Cities and you understand that they look to that for inspiration, you know, you can clearly see, okay, this is French Revolution. This is not Occupy Wall Street. It's not.
And frankly,
it's not a commentary on.
That's giving Occupy Wall Street too much credit as well.
Right.
And it doesn't make sense because it doesn't make. It's obviously.
You know, the Blackgate thing is the storming of the Bastille.
Yeah.
It, you know, right down the line.
I mean, instead of beheadings, you've got plunging through the ice, you know, and then hanging the bodies from the bridge, which
just hanging from the bridge,
which might be the most probably one of the most fleeting but shocking moments in any comic book movie I think I've seen.
And the other thing I think we've discussed just as a side on Facebook and stuff is, you know, one of the ways that people sort of complained about the movie is that Bane is a weak villain compared to the Joker. And I found upon subsequent viewings that that's just not true. You know, the thing that I think we talked about, that first fight between Bane and Batman, no matter how many times I watch it, it is difficult to watch.
It is, yeah.
And there's just not anything like that in The Dark Knight. You know, the Joker is just kind of fun to watch. Even when he's doing something incredibly evil, there's nothing in The Dark Knight. And I love the Joker in that movie. I think he's the perfect villain. I think he's great. I still think he's sort of the Batman nemesis, the perfect Batman nemesis, but there's nothing in that film that continues to be jarring and kind of upsetting to even look at. and as that did not dissipate with that Bane Batman fight, I think Bane kind of grew in my own mind in terms of the quality, his quality as a villain. And I think he stands shoulder to shoulder in a very different way.
Yeah, definitely.
With the Joker.
Maybe more physical, but certainly, and again, this is where I kind of got the whole plan of, you know, this poisoning with hope is just super compelling to me. So now, yeah. And then, I guess I'm wondering what people may have been expecting, and I'm still wondering how much of the politics rubbed people the wrong way, you know, and kind of informed that. But I'll give people the benefit of the doubt and say that maybe were the things we've talked about here. But again, I just think subsequent viewings and just looking at what Nolan is doing with a character, yeah, I mean, remaining faithful largely to a lot of the comic book beats, you know, especially Bane breaking the bat and all that stuff. You know, and Catwoman, I think, is a pitch perfect representation.
I thought that she was the best Catwoman.
Absolutely.
Ever.
Absolutely. And I think right on the money.
That scene in the bar with her is spectacular.
Yeah.
The way that she manipulates every man in the bar, it's very, very Catwoman.
That's true.
And beyond what, you know, it's not that sort of campy, out there Tim Burton weirdo character that Michelle Pfeiffer played, although I think her Catwoman is great. You know, Anne Hathaway's version that seems to function, you know, be able to function on the sly in the real world without people even realizing she's a jewel thief, I thought it was just spot on.
And there's vulnerability too there, which you need. Mm-hmm. Like, I think often, you know, heroes are captivating, not because of, you know, both because of their superpowers and their heroism, but their vulnerabilities as well. And I think too often a lot of female heroes, you know, are either overwritten or, you know, are written to be so, so tough that there's no vulnerabilities there, you know, and it makes them kind of boring sometimes.
And Nolan hits those comic book beats without you feeling like he's self-consciously hitting the comic book beats.
Yeah.
Like that moment when she's sitting on the bat pod, and she's blown a hole in the
barricade, and she can
take off. That is like the perfect Catwoman moment. She is always in the comics or wherever, animated series stuff. She is always in that position of I can get away or I can save Batman's butt.
Yes, yes. And again, we've spoiled like crazy already, but just his, you know, talk about an ingenious use of the idea of Robin too, you know?
Yeah.
It's ingenious. Mm-hmm. But the other thing we wanted to say is, and this is to beat on this movie, but when you juxtapose The Dark Knight Rises with the other big tentpole comic book movie, which is The Avengers, a movie I know we both like, and I like a great deal, it's really difficult to compare them, I think, because they're almost in different genres. Like, The Avengers strikes me as a comic book superhero movie, you know, as you would define a comic book superhero movie. And though Batman is based on a comic book and a superhero, it's a totally different beast. And I think the big word we've used to define the two is safe.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, to me, comparing the two, it's like comparing, you know, Cracker Jacks with filet mignon or something. You know, like, I like both, but I don't eat them for the same reasons.
Right.
And Dark Knight Rises is the filet mignon. I mean, I think there's just more substance there. And more flavor there, but Avengers is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But to say, oh, you know, that's so much better, and that's how I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there was...
That's how The Dark Knight Rises should be? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, there was... You never felt that the ground could give way. And, you know, everyone... It was, you know, it was pretty... It was... They played it pretty safe. So, but again, for what... For the type of movie it was, I think it was pretty much...
I mean, they off Coulson, and that's sort of a surprise.
Right. But again, who's gonna... Like,
but not... You, but you know what?
The Avengers movie, if you said, oh, poor Coulson's gonna get it, how many of the viewing public would know who that is? You know?
Right. And I, you know, I think I had heard that somebody in the movie was going to get it.
Yeah.
Before I saw it. And I immediately thought Coulson. Because who, they're not going to kill off Samuel L. Jackson. They're not going to kill off any of the lead, you know, they're not going to kill off Hawkeye or Black Widow or, and I thought, well, he's the guy who, he's been in every movie just about leading up to this. So we sort of know him. We kind of like him. That seems like the guy to off.
Yeah.
So it did not have the same impact on me that like blowing up Rachel Dawes.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. Had. Right. Yeah. So I don't know. That's not to dump on Avengers because I think it deserves a lot of the fun that was given to it. I mean, I like the Avengers more than any single superhero movie, like featuring those Avengers separately, you know?
Right.
So I think the sum is definitely
greater. By a lot.
The whole is greater than some of its parts, for sure. So,
and that was another one where, honestly, people nitpicked it to death. Like, why did they do this and why did they –
yeah.
And it's like, who cares?
Yeah, absolutely.
Just, from moment to moment, it was a blast.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I will – yeah, for sure.
You know, why did all the guys – they're not droids. Why did they all collapse as soon as the main ship was blown up at the end? They're organic.
Yeah, right.
Things. Why would they all die? Well, because we don't want to sit there for a half an hour and watch them do cleanup. That's why. Yes. I mean, who cares?
Yeah, yeah. So, and I think Joss Whedon deserves a lot of that credit as well. And I think
because that was almost an impossible task.
Almost an impossible task, but he made it, and he put in some laugh out loud moments as well. So,
yes.
I think he was a perfect example for that. So, and again, I feel like if anyone would appreciate Dark Knight Rises and the Nolan stuff, it'd be Joss Whedon as well. So
the thing that I will say this for the Avengers, the thing that makes me laugh out loud every single time, and it's a tiny line, is when Iron Man grabs Hawkeye to put him up on top of that building, and he says, "Clench up, Legolas."
Yeah, it's not bad. Not bad.
Before he launches off. For some reason, that line catches me as funny.
Yeah, for me, it's Thor's perfect delivery of he's adopted. You know,
yes,
that's great.
I like that one, and I like the yay guys at the end. Yay! Let's all take a day off tomorrow.
And the post-credit sequence. Did you see them just sit?
Yes,
that's very good. Just eating food. So, yeah, so good on both of those movies for achieving. I think for probably hitting the top end of the genres that they're operating within. Even though The Dark Knight's probably a genre unto itself. You know,
yeah,
it straddles genres, but. But okay, moving on to what I think is a juicier piece of contrarian. We're being contrarian to the contrarians out there. And honestly, this is something it's certainly not pilloried to the extent of an Adam Sandler comedy or anything, but I am honestly befuddled. As much as I was befuddled by the outpouring of praise for Avatar, I'm befuddled by the mixed reactions and general negativity towards this movie, which I've seen it twice. I'd like to see it a third time. I'm listening to the soundtrack. I was just utterly enchanted by it. It's The Hobbit.
Yes.
And I went into The Hobbit kind of, you know, with some trepidation.
I did too.
I mean, I obviously Lord of the Rings, I love them dearly, and Peter Jackson I have a lot of respect for, but I was kind of like, do we need The Hobbit? Hey, what's going on here? Is this really necessary? And I kind of just went with a buddy of mine. We had gone to see the Lord of the Rings movies. And I said, just go there. I'll go anyway. He had seen it before. He wanted to see it a second time. And he was someone, and I left that theater just head over heels, like just loving it utterly.
Yes.
He loved it. And I was to the point where I was like, I do not understand where someone could dislike this movie. And I've seen it on the top 10 of worst movies of 2012, The Hobbit.
Right.
I just completely baffled by it.
Yeah, I'm baffled as well. And I went in because of all the negativity. I waited 2 weeks, something like that. Mm-hmm. And finally saw it last week, took my son to see it, and was in the same boat where it was like, well, you know, I hope this is not a painful 3 hours or nearly 3 hours. And loved it. And I mean, we came home and we watched over the next, you know, 4 days or so, 4 or 5 days while we were on break, we watched the extended editions of The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, it makes you want
to
watch.
And I have to say, I don't know. It's hard to compare a single movie to a trilogy. And I love the Lord of the Rings trilogy, but I will say unequivocally that I, in terms of a fun experience, I enjoyed The Hobbit more than I enjoyed Fellowship of the Ring.
I think I would agree. I was going to say, is that too contrarian? And I'm going to say that when I first saw Fellowship of the Ring, it just blew me away because I'd never seen anything like it before. Subsequent viewings, I definitely liked it, though. I do remember thinking, these parts are a little slow. Like we're running around to Lothlorien. That's kind of a, you know, kind of dragging our feet, it seems. You know,
there's a lot of setup.
There are pockets of that just kind of dragged. So I was kind of thinking that's what was going to face. But I would say, even of everything, I think The Hobbit is the best paced Middle Earth movie Jackson's done. I think.
Yeah.
I just think.
And I feel like what we saw was the extended version.
I think
like maybe he'll add 40 minutes, but I feel like everything was in there. Whereas Fellowship of the Rings, the theatrical version seems a little tight.
Yeah.
A little bit off in terms of sometimes it's even a little bit faster maybe than it's supposed to be. It's hard to put my finger on. And the extended version seems a little bit long. Although I prefer it.
Yeah, right.
A little bit slow in parts. But, I thought The Hobbit hit it. And I thought, you know, all the sort of kind of quaint, cutesy stuff at the beginning of Fellowship of the Ring, mm-hmm. introducing hobbits and who they are and what they're about. You know, I thought, man, The Hobbit just sort of rips through that. And the dwarves are really compelling and they're genuinely funny.
Yes.
And it's introducing important stuff. And I really think Bilbo, for me, is a more interesting protagonist than Frodo is.
I agree.
He's less mopey. I thought Martin Freeman was great.
I think you got to give a lot of that to Martin Freeman. Like Elijah Wood did well for sure, but I think Martin.
That's a shame. With all this complaining, Freeman's performance is just getting ignored.
You're right, and I mean maybe he's not the biggest star in the world, but he is just perfect for that. And I would think. Like, the Fellowship of the Ring was pretty straightforward structurally. You have exposition, a little bit of action, more exposition, like big action scene, take a breath and do some more, and then end on a huge action scene. The structure in Hobbit was, like, pretty interesting, I thought. Like, it was so well-paced. And for one thing, I mean, the biggest complaint you hear is it's too long, right? That's the biggest complaint. Too long, too much, too lengthy. But, A, I did not want it to end. I'll tell you that much. Did not want it to end. Like, I was thinking, all right, Thorin and the white orc are going to have some epic battle at the end, right? Right? Right?
Right.
And then it ends, leaving me desperate for the follow-up, you know, on a great cliffhanger as well. But it's paced so marvelously. Like, you have a lot of action backloaded on the end to the fact I was thinking, okay, we're going to pause, have some, you know, decompression, and then we'll get one final orc siege, and then Thorin and the white orc will battle. But no, there's a ton of action at the end, and then you kind of wrap things up. So it's just so, you know, yes, there's
you
a good thing
here,
but you have to know
emotional level where Thorin accepts Bilbo.
That's right. Yes, that's right. The emotion, you're right. The emotional capper is, definitely serves that purpose. But I just think, like, the structure just works so well. And like you had said, it's genuinely funny. Because there were a couple moments of mirth, pretty much all supplied by Gimli the dwarf in the three Lord of the Rings. But that movie, as much as I love it, sometimes it's so heavy that it's just so heavy.
It's so heavy that some of the Gimli stuff is just almost too ridiculous in order to like the heaviness.
That's right. It stands out so much.
You know, he's too much the butt of jokes.
And everyone Lord of the Rings, speaks, in these, like they're all Norse gods in Olympus or something,
Right.
Or Norse god, wherever Norse gods live. But, just like everything's got weight. Every piece of dialogue uttered has weight. And that's great because it fits that particular trilogy, I guess. But The Hobbit, it seemed more breezy, to disparage it, but it just.
No, and it should be. That's how
the language was more engaging. The dwarves were, just like you said, like, little bits that I loved. And in fact, I hadn't read The Hobbit before. I'm reading it now. And it's kind of a fun inverse to read the book after seeing the movie because you can see that Peter Jackson, took he changed some things around, but he was pretty close to it. They took scenes and lines directly from it. But, like, right. Love the little moments of, like, Gandalf doing the head count on the dwarves because he feels responsible for them. So he's counting them all. That's great. I think they're stopping Lothlorien – or in their stop in Elrond without in Rivendell. That could have dragged. But they were kind of in and out of there.
Took it along, yeah.
They were in and out, and they got, like, some big stuff talked about, and they hinted at some really great – you know, loved how they're hinting at what's to come and a great appearance by Saruman, which I was genuinely surprised by, so –
yeah, I mean, my theory about this is all the complaints about pacing and everything else, are what they are really about is there's two ways that Peter Jackson could have made this movie. He could have made it very literally like the book, just followed the book the way that it is. And it would have been a two-part movie, I think. You could maybe squeeze it into one part, but I think you'd have to cut out some major sections. And it would be tonally a very, very different movie than the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Or you can do what he did, which is take a whole bunch of stuff from the appendices
that sort of
explain how The Hobbit fits into this larger story, The Lord of the Rings, and how it leads into it and other things that were going on while Bilbo was on this journey and everything, on this quest, and explore that. And he's taken some liberties with some of it, like he did in Lord of the Rings, but most of it is pretty much spot on from stuff that Tolkien wrote elsewhere, in appendices, in the Silmarillion, wherever. I'm not sure. And it's fine if you're a critic and you want to say, I don't like that approach, I wish he had done it a straight-up adaptation of the book, then say that. But don't say, oh, there's a pacing problem here.
Right.
There's a pacing problem there because there's stuff in there that you didn't expect from having read the book and you don't necessarily want in there. That's not a pacing problem. That's a problem with your expectations.
But again, I am baffled at the fact that there'd be a perceived pacing problem. I mean,
yeah,
I can't believe how that movie zipped by, I thought.
Unless there's stuff in there, like the white orc and stuff, that you don't think should be in there. And so the entire time you're watching it, you're thinking, I don't want to be seeing this. Then I could see how,
I guess, right?
You know, subjectively you could go, this is, I wish this was a half an hour shorter because I wish a half hour of this stuff didn't get filmed and inserted in here. But that's not a pacing issue. That's an issue of you wanting the movie to be made differently than it has been made.
Or the fact
– so argue that if you're a critic.
I don't
say, I wish the appendices stuff wasn't in here.
Or just – I guess the cynic in me is just saying you maybe want to take Jackson down a notch or so. You know?
Right.
Or we don't – I don't know. I just –
that too.
I've got nothing. I think that's a good point you make, but I'm just wondering if
it's all the, you know, there. I mean, I think it started with it being split into three films, which I'm still, you know, I don't know exactly how that's going to work, but after seeing the first one, I'm like, hey, I'm there for the ride.
Yeah, right.
You know?
I'm on board.
I hope it works out. And then there's the 48 FPS thing. And for me, we saw it in 24, so I don't know what it looked, I don't know
here.
If it looks like the Super Bowl in 48, maybe it does. I do know that the image was incredibly crisp, especially compared to Fellowship, where everything is filtered and everything has this sort of orange, yellow color timing and everything. And, I don't know whether that's, I haven't been able to wrap my mind around whether that is just a technology thing and this is the way the movie looks because this is how it's shot. Or whether it is a purposeful choice by Jackson because he wants – it would make logical sense if the Fellowship of the Ring and Two Towers and Return of the King looked autumnal and wintry.
Yeah.
And if The Hobbit looks more like summer. Just in terms of thematically, if you're going to connect them all up, The Hobbit is happening in a much happier time.
Yes.
In Middle Earth than Lord of the Rings were. And maybe that's his choice, and I'm certainly willing to give him the benefit of the doubt until we see all three films and see how it all fits together.
And I have to say, one of the other things that jumped out to me, you know, about the brilliance of The Hobbit was so we're essentially looking at a prequel trilogy here. And yes, the source material is how you have the source material, you know. But it just seems like such a natural fit for, you know, like I can already see how it fits into the Lord of the Rings trilogy. You know, you could already see all the connective tissue kind of that's cropping up to hold it together. And, I mean, and to me it's like, if, again, projecting out that this thing continues the quality, and knowing how Lord of the Rings trilogy really, you know, maintain that quality throughout, I have no reason to think that The Hobbit won't.
Right. And I don't know why Peter Jackson wouldn't go down that path, because this is exactly what Tolkien wrote, is that Radagast, mm-hmm. I guess the dude with the rabbits, began figuring out that this necromancer was Sauron.
Yes,
around the time when Bilbo was on this quest. Right. So if you've already made Lord of the Rings, why wouldn't you include that plot line?
That's right. And I love these little, like, how Gandalf is doing this quest to learn a little bit more, because he's beginning to sense the stirring in the darkness. And he also looks at Smaug as being kind of a tactical nuclear weapon, right?
Right.
That could be utilized.
The other thing is, when you look at the Lord of the Rings and, like, what the prelude, the little prologue at the beginning of Lord of the Rings, the first one, says, where it says the ring abandoned Gollum and stuff, you want that necromancer thing in there, because you want to be reminded that Bilbo didn't just find that ring.
Right.
It purposely left Gollum.
That's because it knew.
Because it knew that this necromancer, or, you know, Sauron is out there. He's starting to build his power. It's time to start moving towards the events that are going to happen in Lord of the Rings.
That's right. That's right. I just think that this is positioning itself now to be just like how you make a prequel trilogy. Again, you've got the source material, so that's a big help. But, I mean, I know we don't hate on the Star Wars prequel trilogy as a lot of other people do, but it's certainly, you know, it's only pales compared to the... Right.
And it's not necessary.
Yeah, and it's not necessary. It kind of pales in comparison to the original trilogy. We understand that. But, like, now you're looking at something that can be both necessary and just a perfect compliment. So you're all of a sudden looking at this complete, like, this epic, complete saga, you know, that...
Right.
You're starting off, like you said, with, like, mirth and dwarf jokes and songs and ale and The Hobbit.
But I loved how they were, you know, just what that said about them, that they were a bunch of roughnecks.
Yes.
And, you know, Bilbo's not used to that. He's very uncomfortable. You know, they're sort of blue-collar
dudes.
And Bilbo's a white-collar guy, and he just doesn't get along with these guys, and they're trashing everything and getting mud everywhere. But they're having a good time with each other, even though they're going to go on this difficult quest. And they're not – all of them aren't all that bright. And, you know, they've complained about – some critics have complained that there's too many of them. You can't keep track of all of them, and they're not all important. And that, you know, that's another one where it's like, well, let's give it 3 movies and see what they all do. You know, I don't need to know all of them well, movie one. And I feel like I knew enough of them well enough. And especially, you know, it's one of those density things. Like, I don't need to understand everything the first time I see it. And when we went and watched Lord of the Rings after that, I realized there were some connections there that are really interesting. You know, the dwarf who's in the tomb in Fellowship of the Ring is one of those 13.
That's right.
Gimli's father is one of those 13. And when you look at him, you can tell it's Gimli's father. They look similar, you know.
Definitely.
Thorin is a very dynamic character.
And I have, again, I know kind of the general layout of The Hobbit, but I am reading it now. And I think, you know, it seems like you're going to get to a point, too, where you're going to be getting to see the transition of Middle Earth under the dominion of men, you know, because men are going to come into play with a hobbit as well. You know, I think like Bard the Bowman, I think he's in there. So, you know, they hinted that at the beginning, right? The human city that's right at the foot of the dwarf capital.
Yeah.
So I think that'll be kind of interesting.
It's going to end in a killer battle.
We know
the
that.
The stuff is going to be badass.
I think it's probably smelling to be like you're going to get Smaug craziness in the second movie, but the third movie seems like it might be dominated by the Battle of the Five Armies, which could be unbelievable. This is one of those movies that I would see it right now. If someone called me and said let's go see it, I would do it right now.
Yeah.
It's just a great, and I am just befuddled by.
Right. I mean, when I came out with my 7-year-old, I asked him what he thought of that, and his response was that it is one of my favorite movies ever.
I mean,
he didn't say that for the Avengers.
Right.
I mean, he rarely says that, but I think it's probably, if you asked him right now, it would be top of the list of his favorite movies of all time. And I give credence to that because I look back and think, what are the big movies when I was his age. Star Wars had that kind of impact on me when I was his age. So, you know, it could be a movie that he really lives with his entire life.
And I will go on to say this. I will go on to say this. As much as we just lavish praise on Dark Knight Rises, The Hobbit might be my favorite movie of 2012.
It's pretty awesome.
I mean, it's like just as far as everything, just the expectations that I had, how they blew them out of the water, just the straight entertainment. Like, I mean, those two are really close to me, but I mean, how it just really blew out my expectations, I might give it the nod. But both of them, to me, are some of the finest genre filmmaking I've seen in years. You know, maybe since, you know, obviously since Dark Knight and probably since Lord of the Rings, ironically. So, all right. Absolutely. So let's wrap up this podcast with a little looking forward. So that's kind of our looking at the douchebaggery that the douchebaggery backlash.
Yes. So if you're being a douchebag or you've been a douchebag in 2012, our recommendation is go back, watch The Dark Knight Rises a few times, watch The Hobbit a few more times, especially when it comes out on Blu-ray. You're going to want that in high definition.
Definitely.
And see if they don't grow on you.
And think about how it connects to Lord of the Rings, too, because I think there's a lot of, you know, there's just a lot of cool
Neither stuff. Is a movie where you can get everything in a single view.
Or I think, and I don't think they achieve their biggest potential if you see them isolated from their companions. You know, I think watching the Lord of the Rings trilogy adds a lot to The Hobbit, and obviously you need to see the first two ones and really kind of to look at the scope of what Nolan's doing for The Dark Knight Rises. But moving forward, we're going to do an Oscar preview. So, you know, trust this because we don't do this often.
And we're for one statue because we don't like the Oscars.
We don't like the Oscars. So we're going to look at one category, which is Best Leading Actor. And this is going to give us a chance to talk about an objection / old white man cabal favorite of ours.
Yes.
It's Best Actor, and it's we're probably in the consensus here, I would say. I think there's a good chance we're not being contrarian here. But both of us have seen Les Miserables, so we're going to grant Hugh Jackman the statuette.
But not Daniel Day-Lewis, he was in Last of the Mohicans, which is one of our favorites.
Yes, and that deserves as much glory as it's given to. But again, we posit as, you know, we both like Les Mis. My small side contrarian here is that I actually liked the late 90s Liam Neeson version of Les Miserables, which was no singing and focused exclusively on Javert and Valjean, and that, which I would highly recommend.
Is that like a two-part miniseries?
No, it's just a straight movie. Because
I've got some kind of two-part thing queued up in Netflix, so.
Yeah, no, this is just the Les Mis from – it actually was released recently, obviously, to coincide with the film. But, yeah, Claire Danes is in it. Uma Thurman is Fontaine. So that stuff's cool, but I'm a big fan of that movie, and I probably prefer that over this version, though this version is cool. But it gives, at the very least, whatever you think, Hugh Jackman may – although Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, he might not have that sewn up, people seem to think. But we want to endorse Hugh Jackman receiving the statue, but not necessarily – for Les Miserables, Dan.
Yeah. Well, this year for Les Miserables. As we all know, the Oscars tend to award actors, or movies for that matter, or directors, with prizes for performances that are late. You know, they don't necessarily deserve them for that performance, but they missed the opportunity, the Academy did, to give them the Oscar for what they really deserve it for. And we think that Hugh Jackman should have gotten it last year.
Last year, yeah.
Do you want to reveal?
Yeah, it's for Real Steel.
Yes.
Let's make no bones about it. Real Steel, a criminally underrated movie, I think. And I don't think that was – I'm not sure if that was hammered by the critics. You know, I think it was,
but I think most people whose opinions I value
tend to like
really it. Liked it.
But Real
Rocky
Steel,
plus Rock'em Sock'em Robots, now, which does admittedly sound like it would be horrible, but
– no. My theory is Real Steel is the perfect movie, maybe until The Hobbit came along, but the perfect movie for a father and son to watch together.
Yes. Yeah.
It is pretty much the perfect – if you want –
I think you'd have to go back to Over the Top.
There you go. That's right. I mean, I think that I remember I got Real Steel to review on Blu-ray. And I can't remember – I don't know if it was given to me or if I requested it, but, you know, expectations low with that one.
Yes.
And I just had a huge smile on my face when I was done watching that. And a lot of that is attributed. Yes, the Rock'em Sock'em Robots are great. Yes, the kid is not annoying, which is huge. You know, it's so easy to have a precocious, annoying kid. He managed not to be annoying. And we had an Evangeline Lilly freed from the constraints of Lost. I mean, it's good to have her running around there. But a lot of it's got to be laid at the feet of Hugh Jackman, who, even though it was kind of good time, lightweight, family film, He gave it his all, I thought. I thought he was earnest.
And he always does.
He does, man. He gives you his money's worth. He is earnest. He obviously was not cashing a check. And I just think that he really kind of made that. I mean, with the character such, you know, washed up dad, you know, trying to reconnect with son. Yeah, we've seen that before, but he just injected a lot of fun in it. And basically I guess we're just thinking he deserves us not only because of Real Steel, but Hugh Jackman is pretty awesome.
He is pretty awesome.
I mean, where the douchebag cynics that we can be, the a-holes that we can be sometimes, I think we got to give it up to Hugh Jackman, who...
And we're talking about a man who, I mean, we love action movies.
Yes.
We love cheesy, hard R, violent action movies. And Hugh Jackman is clearly a guy who a large part of him just wants to be a song and dance man.
There you go.
You know,
there's a song.
This is not the kind of guy that we would normally gravitate to as one of our favorite actors, I don't think. But, you know, he just delivers the goods every single time. Is in The Prestige, which is one of my favorite movies.
Another great Nolan, right?
Delivers it there.
Yep.
Does a great job. And is really great in Les Miserables.
Yes.
And hopefully does not get overshadowed by Anne Hathaway, who's also phenomenal in the movie. But, you know, I think Jackman in a lot of ways carries that flick. Because
he's in it
from beginning to end.
And I would... We just talked about it. I like Anne Hathaway more in Dark Knight Rises, really, than Les Mis.
Yeah.
Because as far as I'm concerned, Les Mis, it was her dream, her one song, you know, and it was great. And she belted it out like a champ, you know, but.
With an enormous amount of emotion.
Enormous amount of emotion. Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, she'll probably win it, but I would say that I think her biggest accomplishment was convincing some cynical fanboys that Catwoman could be cool and part of Nolan's universe, and she did that. So,
yes.
Or maybe it's her just in leather splayed out on a motorcycle, too. Maybe that's coloring the image as well. But, Hugh Jackman carries that thing, man. He's like, I think he's the only, I mean, he's really like the only lead actor. I mean, everyone else kind of is in supporting roles. So, So this is kind of our endorsement for Hugh Jackman and for Real Steel, by the way, which should definitely be viewed. And he seems like a pretty good guy. I can't remember being lectured to by Hugh Jackman. Can you?
No.
Always.
So, sorry, Daniel Day-Lewis. You know, you looked extraordinarily like Lincoln, but I don't necessarily think that's reason to.
Though he does deserve some kind of fine performance. He does deserve some kind of honorable Last of the Mohicans award, don't you think?
Yes. Yeah.
So, I mean,
I think he's
biggest badass.
See, he won from My Left Foot, right? Did that come out before or after Mohicans? I don't remember. Probably before.
No, before. I think it was before.
Okay, well,
I think
he needs to win something retroactively for Last of the Mohicans.
Yes, that's right.
Did he win for There Will Be Blood?
Ooh, good question.
He might have.
Criminal, yeah. I mean,
if he did, that was really for Last of the Mohicans.
That's true. Yeah. Any awards forthcoming are retroactive to Last of the Mohicans, for sure.
Yes, so. Yeah. I mean, his hair alone.
His hair, absolutely.
Last of the Mohicans deserves... some sort of award.
And all the running he does in the woods.
Yeah, he did a lot of running.
I mean,
carrying a musket, which, you know, had to weigh...
Running,
you know,
and loading two muskets simultaneously is not going to be...
Firing two muskets simultaneously while running at the end. That's fantastic.
That is fantastic. Dual-wielding muskets.
With flowing hair that made women of the early 90s weak in the knees.
Yo.
Guaranteed.
I guarantee that. I mean, if I will find you, I mean, that alone will... We'll break down any barrier.
Waterfall. I've been looking for the opportunity for
the waterfall jump.
Nearly two decades.
Yeah.
Be able to tell my wife, stay alive, I will find you, and then jump
off the waterfall. Yeah, good luck. When that happens, that'll be a glorious day.
It will be.
Well, you know what? I think, so not to give Daniel Day a short shrift, but his waterfall jumping does deserve recognition at some point, but not at the expense of our man, Hugh Jackman. So, and we will see what he comes up with in yet another Wolverine movie, which hopefully... Again, he gives it his all, but he's been kind of trapped in some bad Wolverine stuff, so maybe we'll get...
Yeah, he needs to Sean Connery that role and hand it over to someone else and...
Timothy Dalton, perhaps.
Move on.
Timothy Dalton in the Wolverine role, see what happens.
T-Dalton as Wolverine would be magnificent.
It would be magnificent, yes.
But T-Dalton as anything
would
be magnificent.
That is
T-Dalton should have played Lincoln.
That is essentially the OWC. Okay, just the other thing, another little digression, but obviously with Skyfall, which was awesome.
Yes.
Which is great. And maybe we'll have to revisit some Bond stuff, but there was a lot of Bond things going on, a lot of Bond countdowns, and I was just repeatedly amazed at how low T. Dalt's efforts rank. I mean, I think...
Yeah, it's very disheartening.
I saw a countdown where Living Daylights ranked under Moonraker and Octopussy.
That's outrageous. That is outrageous. Now, I'll be the first to say that I wish that his movies had been better, but I think he's outstanding in both of them. You know, I wish that, especially Living Daylights, had been better than it was. That feels like a Roger Moore film that Timothy Dalton stumbled into.
That's right.
Living Daylights, I mean, License to Kill is quite a bit better, but, you know, I wish he had had Casino Royale level of material.
Well, let's be honest. Just the mere presence of Necros elevates Octopussy. Come on now.
Yeah. Come on.
Remember
like,
Jack and
like
Necros?
There's anything other than Moonraker possibly that is worse than Octopussy.
I know.
I mean, even
maybe Woody Allen's Casino
is ridiculous.
all right. Well, I think on that note, I think we'll wrap up this looking forward, looking back edition of Objection. We fulfilled our. I think we can now. The old one man cabal can now deduct this from 2012's taxes. We'll fudge the recording. We'll say we recorded this on December 1st, so they can take that deduction. So
well, you know, the old white man cabal is 1% of the 1%. So they're so. So powerful and so influential and rich that they can do whatever they want to with the tax code. The old white man cabal's not paying anything.
That's true. You're right.
Because you know, they have loopholes of their own. Most of the 1%, 99% of the 1% cannot access these loopholes. So.
Yeah, it's like the American Express black card.
You know, right.
They've got those loopholes. So yeah.
Unless they physically start to take scotch away from taxpayers, the old white man cabal will not be affected by anything that Congress or the president does. Scotch and cigars.
Yeah, the scotch tax. Now, that'll finally put people over the edge, I think. Can't do the scotch tax. All right, well, with that being said, I guess there's just one more thing to say.
Thanks, 10 points easy.